as if they'd all been born to the same queen. Edward first, because he was a boy, and then the girl, starting with Mary and followed by Elizabeth. And that is exactly what happened. They all reigned one after another and died childless. The Tudor line, which Henry had wreaked so much havoc trying to secure, was doomed anyway. Chapter 36. King Edward VI. I once saw the diplomatic genius of the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 explained as having allowed both sides of the argument over Northern Ireland's sovereignty to exist almost in parallel universes where each had got what it wanted. To Irish Republicans, there was now no border, so Ireland was united. Practically speaking, that was the reality. Meanwhile, to Unionists, Northern Ireland remained part of the United Kingdom. This, too, was an undeniable fact. Both sides could feel like they'd basically won. Everyone was sick of all the killing, and this gave both sides the excuse to give the killing a rest. In terms of the Reformation, Henry VIII acted almost like a big, terrifying, smelly and angry Good Friday Agreement. His muddled and changing conception of the church allowed both sides to think that the national religion was basically what they wanted. At core, Henry remained a Catholic who believed in most of Catholic doctrine and was deeply suspicious of the more egalitarian elements of the reformers' agenda, so the Catholics could feel like the church was still fundamentally theirs. Meanwhile, the reformers could rightly reflect on the huge changes that had been made, the break with papal authority and the destruction of all monastic institutions and all the heretical praying for the souls of the dead in non-existent purgatory that that entailed. They must have felt in the ascendant too. This fudge could not last. It didn't have enough sugar in it. There was no way of bringing up the new king to believe the same jumble of stuff his father had, because it wasn't at all coherent without Henry's presiding personality. Edward had to be brought up either as a Catholic or as a Protestant. Well, it was Protestant, and he really took to it. He was only 9 when he became king, but he had received a top-class education. He was articulate, pious, and he hated the Pope. At the start of his reign, his uncle, Jane Seymour's brother Edward, snatched the reins of power from the Regency Council that Henry VIII had planned and had himself made Lord Protector of the Realm and Duke of Somerset. He ran things relatively badly, paying for England's desultory wars against France and Scotland by debasing the coinage. This led to inflation and exacerbated the agrarian hardship already being caused by the widespread practice among landowners of enclosing common land, preventing the peasantry from using it. Somerset seemed sympathetic to the plight of those affected by this and set up a couple of commissions to look into it. They achieved nothing other than elevating the hopes of the poor, who then rebelled when their circumstances failed to improve. In 1549, there were widespread insurrections on a level not seen since the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Weapons of mass destruction. It's not the economy, stupid. It's the church. Of the two major rebellions, the one focused around Norwich was primarily a response to enclosure, and indeed claimed to be acting legally on behalf of Somerset's commissioners. But the other one, down in the West Country, was about the imposition of Protestantism. The Act of Uniformity of 1549 imposed Protestant worship via Archbishop Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer on the whole kingdom. To most people at the time, this was shocking and ungodly. Even to some of the ruling class, despite the overt Protestantism of the king and his regime, a party of religious conservatives still existed at court, and they took the popular rebellions during Somerset's rule as an excuse to remove him by allying with his Protestant opponents. Most notable among these was John Dudley, Earl of Warwick. He supplanted Somerset, had himself made Duke of Northumberland, and then sloughed off his Catholic backers by appealing to the dyed-in-the-wool Protestantism of the king. He declared Edward ready for rule, and so was not made Lord Protector, but Lord President of the Council. Effectively, it was Somerset's role, though Northumberland filled it more competently. So, a newly self-created Duke of Northumberland was in charge in place of the newly self-created Duke of Somerset. In a way, this unprepossessing wrangle was the inevitable consequence of a minority. The magnates will always squabble for influence. But this was also a Seymour being supplanted by a Dudley. These were not old families. These men are not royal dukes. In the Tudor age, the horizon of ambition is widening, and I'm not talking about the rise of the middle class. These families saw what the Tudors had done and didn't see why they couldn't do the same. Now that the bossy fatso had died and his one orphan was the nominal root of power, it felt like a perfect time to change the royal family's surname. Throughout this, Cranmer was working away making everything Protestant in a steady parliamentary way, which appalled Catholics and also appalled some reformers who thought he should be acting more quickly and upsettingly. In 1550, Stephen Gardiner, the staunchly Catholic Bishop of Winchester, who was in prison at the time, threw a spanner in Cranmer's reforming works by expressing approval for the Book of Common Prayer, basically saying that it could be interpreted in a Catholic way. This seemed to justify Cranmer's reforming critics, who said he hadn't been upsetting enough. It was like he was a teenage girl who had put on a short skirt to go to a party, and then her parents had just said, "Have a nice time, darling." Nightmare. Cranmer had to stomp back upstairs to look for something so skimpy it showed his religion. Please enjoy the questions that this metaphor raises. In 1552, he had another go at upsetting Bishop Gardiner with another act of uniformity and a second edition of the Book of Common Prayer. Then it became clear that the king was going to die. He had tuberculosis and gradually weakened from January 1553 onwards. This wasn't just a problem for the poor young king, it was a problem for Protestantism and for the political and literal survival of the reformer aristocracy. The focus of Northumberland's worry was that the next person in the line of succession was Princess Mary, who was very, very Roman Catholic. She had seen her mother, Catherine of Aragon, humiliated and sidelined, and herself declared a bastard in defiance of the Pope, whom her father had then renounced and dared to supersede. She'd always been a Catholic, but this life experience had only made her more so. Edward and Northumberland were agreed that they had somehow to stop Mary taking the crown after him. It would be a disaster, they felt. After all, not only was she Catholic, she was a woman. So the young ailing king composed what he called his devise for the succession, in which Mary and his other half-sister Elizabeth, who was Protestant but still a woman, were passed over in favour of the male descendants of a group of other Protestant women. These women were Frances Grey, daughter of another Mary Tudor, who was Henry VIII's younger sister, and her three daughters, the eldest of whom was called Lady Jane Grey. This document was questionable to start with. It was an attempt to override Henry VIII's 1543 Act of Succession. But as Edward's death approached, it became questionabler. It was changed, possibly by Edward, but possibly by Northumberland, and definitely at Northumberland's instigation. The phrase "L. Jane's heirs males" became "L. Jane and her heirs males." As you will have spotted, an "and her" was inserted, so that Lady Jane Grey herself became Edward's chosen heir to the throne. This was weird. Suddenly the idea that the ruler shouldn't be a woman was out of the window. Even if you accept that shift of view and move on to Edward's other requirement, that the ruler should be Protestant, it still doesn't make sense. The next in line should have been his sister Elizabeth, and then his first cousin Francis, before his first cousin once removed, Lady Jane Grey. What was it about Lady Jane Grey, who was still in her teens, that had attracted such favour? She had just married Northumberland's son, Lord Guildford Dudley. Yes, the Dudleys were going for it. After 68 years of the House of Tudor, make way for the House of Dudley. On the 6th of July, 1553, Edward died. Northumberland kept this quiet to give himself time to get his ducks in a row. Then, on the 10th, Lady Jane Grey was taken to the Tower of London and proclaimed Queen of England. Chapter 37. Lady Jane Grey. I didn't know whether to give her a chapter. In the end I did, because I felt sorry for her. She didn't want to be queen, and responded to the news with trepidation and then a nervous sense of religious duty. She was a devout Protestant and, like the late king, thought it vital that England's monarch should continue the reforming agenda and not revert to Catholicism, which she considered to be heresy. But she was being used by her father-in-law in his attempt to retain power and to become part of the royal family himself. Despite being only 15 years old, she didn't lack gumption and, for example, refused to allow her husband, Northumberland's son, to be proclaimed king. He had no royal blood, and she determined that it would be her, not him, who would be the ruler. But there her power ended. It was up to Northumberland to consolidate the attempted usurpation, of which she was the figurehead. This he couldn't do. Before Edward died, Princess Mary had left London for her castle at Kenninghall in Norfolk. Northumberland's failure to prevent this was a big mistake from which he never recovered. Mary made it clear that she considered herself the rightful queen, and popular support swiftly gathered around her in East Anglia. Catholics rallied to her, of course, but so did many Protestants who saw the absurdity of Lady Jane Grey's sketchy claim. Mary was a daughter of Henry VIII, a princess of the blood, royal through and through. Lady Jane Grey, despite her tenuous blood claim, felt like a random member of the aristocracy. On the 14th of July, Northumberland rode out of London at the head of a small force to try and arrest Princess Mary, but it became clear that he would be met by an overwhelmingly larger force. On the 20th of July, when he was at Cambridge, a letter arrived from the Privy Council in London saying that they had proclaimed Mary Queen. He went quietly and was executed on the 22nd of August. Lady Jane Grey was executed too, though not until the following year. She'd been convicted of treason, but Queen Mary was inclined to mercy because she knew how blameless Jane was. Nonetheless, when Jane's father and two brothers joined a rebellion against the new queen, Mary concluded that she couldn't risk letting the girl live. On the 12th of February 1554, Jane was beheaded. Like Edward V, she never really ruled, and was killed because of other people's political ambitions. Unlike Edward V, at the moment of her death, she was also denounced as a traitor. What a bitter insult to add to mortal injury. Chapter 38. Queen Mary the First. Queen Mary was known as Bloody Mary because of the large number of people she killed, and also because of misogyny. She was the first properly crowned woman to rule as Queen Regnant, not just Queen Consort. You weren't supposed to be able to do this job if you were a woman, so a lot of people didn't like it. That may be why she gets the sobriquet Bloody when many of her male predecessors were responsible for more deaths, in battles as well as executions. That said, if you're going by executions alone, Queen Mary was right up the leaderboard. She had almost 300 Protestants killed, mostly by burning. Something else that undermines the Bloody thing. Beheadings feel bloody, burnings are more ashy. Or smoky. Smoky Mary would sound quite sexy, like a jazz singer, but from the sound of her, that too would have been inappropriate. Still, considering the form of execution she favoured, it seems odd to associate her with a non-flammable liquid. The image of her that comes down to us is of a dour figure, usually depicted wearing black. At first glance, she looks a lot more puritanical than her Protestant would-be nemesis, Lady Jane Grey. That's not a mistake you'd survive making to her face. She was Catholic to the core and had lived a life of suffering because of it, sidelined and reduced to bastardy by her father's epoch-making midlife crisis. In 1536, after her mother's death, she had written a humiliating letter of apology and supplication to her father, which resulted in her return to court and ultimately to the line of succession, but she obviously felt very guilty and bitter about it. In 1557, the Venetian ambassador to her court, Giovanni Michieli, described her as very grave. Her eyes are so piercing that they inspire not only respect, but fear in those on whom she fixes them. Besides the facility and quickness of her understanding, which comprehends whatever is intelligible to others, she is skilled in five languages, not merely understanding, but speaking four of them fluently. So, sad, harsh, and clever. The main thing about Mary was that she turned the whole country Roman Catholic again. Frankly, the idea is exhausting. Impatient though I am with those of my fellow opponents of Brexit who now say that we have to accept it and move on, when I think about England going Catholic again, I get a sense of where they're coming from. Sometimes nothing matters more than the avoidance of more hassle. Not much fun. My feelings about this are informed by the fact that I know, which Mary and co. did not, that England broke with Rome again after her reign and never returned to the papal aegis. If Mary's had been the final move, it would be Henry's and Edward's rejection of the Pope that would feel like the waste of energy. Mary thought or hoped that she was setting right a brief aberration. Key to keeping the aberration brief was preventing a Protestant inheriting the throne after her, so she needed to produce some heirs who'd then be higher in the line of succession than her Protestant half-sister Elizabeth. She was 37 at the time of her accession, which to this day the NHS startlingly classifies as a geriatric mother. It's unnecessarily extremist terminology today, but in the 16th century, when no one had a clue about germs, it really was a grand old age for popping one out. In order to have a probably fatal pregnancy, Mary needed first to have sex with a man, and in order to have sex with a man, she needed to get married. That was her strong feeling. You can't go burning hundreds of Protestants over what a wafer is made of if you've got a racy sideline in extramarital sex. Smoky Mary might get away with it, but not her buttoned-up namesake Bloody. Mary's magnates, led by Bishop Gardiner, who'd been let out of prison the moment she took the throne, wanted her to marry someone English, such as Edward Courtney, son of the Marquess of Exeter, who'd been in the Tower for ever such a long time for being Catholic and deserved a treat. But Mary wasn't having it. She wanted a big, international, dynastic marriage, even though this made the English fear that the kingdom would then be dominated by a foreign power. They were already worried about that sort of thing, what with Mary's keenness to do whatever the Pope wanted. If Mary's aim had been to allay their fears, her choice of husband was idiotic. If her aim was to give birth to a healthy child, it was idiotic too, though I suppose we can't expect her to understand genetics. She chose Prince Philip, son of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, Mary's mother's nephew, and, as discussed, a man already suffering severe effects of inbreeding. Philip was marrying his cousin, but then his mother, Isabella of Portugal, was his father's cousin, so it was a family tradition. He and Mary never had a child. Mary thought she was pregnant a couple of times, but she was probably wrong, which was probably for the best. The prospect of the eldest son of the great Habsburg imperial potentate becoming Mary's husband and therefore jure uxoris, by right of his wife, King of England, sounded nightmarish to lots of English people. The Protestants hated the idea because the Habsburgs were extremely Catholic. So did anyone at all xenophobic, and that was most people. In January 1554, this sparked Wyatt's Rebellion, led by Sir Thomas Wyatt, son of another Sir Thomas Wyatt, the famous poet. This was the uprising that Lady Jane Grey's family joined in with and that led to her execution. The leaders of the rebellion wanted to restore Protestantism, but many of the people who followed it favoured the old faith. The strength of pro-Catholic feeling among ordinary people had become clear the previous summer when Mary swept aside Lady Jane Grey. It was only anti-Spanish sentiment that united it. A fear that, since at the time husbands were masters of their wives, Philip would be master of Mary and therefore of England. It caused an anxious moment for the new regime, particularly when the Duke of Norfolk led a force out of London to take on the rebels, which then defected en masse to Wyatt's side, leaving the Duke scurrying back to town. The Queen's fortitude in addressing her own troops at London's Guildhall on the 2nd of February was crucial to turning the momentum of events against the rebels. They were defeated. Any spirit of optimism that accompanied the new reign had also been snuffed out. No fun at all. There were a couple of positives. In 1554, the Queen Regent's Prerogative Act was passed, which made explicit for the first time that when a woman inherited the throne, became the sovereign, queen regnant rather than consort, she enjoyed the same powers as a king. Or had them, anyway. It really doesn't seem like she enjoyed them. In the same spirit, the Queen's Marriage Act of the same year made it clear that while Philip, once they were married, would be accorded the same honour and respect as a king, the power lay with her, and as soon as their marriage ended, so did his rights as a ruler. This was a forthright response to people's fears about Philip, and treated him with a humiliating level of suspicion. But he took it on his weird Habsburg chin. Those guys played a long game. Emperor Maximilian's deft and lucky playing of the royal marriage market meant that his grandson, Charles V, ruled most of Germany, Italy, Spain and the Netherlands, as well as, thanks to Christopher Columbus, an increasing chunk of South America. The strategy was clear. Why conquer when you can just inherit? Had Mary and Philip been blessed with a son, he would have been a Habsburg and a Catholic King of England by right. In general, it was a miserable reign. Apart from anything else, it rained a hell of a lot. It gets us down today. Back then, it made thousands of people die. Crops failed, so there was famine and then disease. The sense of God's favour that everyone at the time looked for seemed entirely lacking, as it poured and people starved or died of disease, warming themselves on the burning Protestant martyrs. Religious divisions got so nasty. Wyatt's rebellion had straightforwardly sought to kill Mary and put Elizabeth on the throne. The ringleaders weren't really pretending otherwise. There was no talk of bad counsellors that they wanted to remove, as there usually had been when people rose against rulers in the past. Similarly, no one questioned Mary's dynastic right to rule, other than to assert her bastardy because of the annulment of her mother's marriage to Henry VIII. All that bloodline stuff was old hat. Now it was all about religion. Her legitimacy, or otherwise, lay in the fact that she was a Catholic. There is an irony that the key figure who helped her turn England Catholic again, Cardinal Pole, the papal legate who became Archbishop of Canterbury when Cranmer was sacked, was actually another White Rose, a direct descendant of Edward IV's younger brother, the Duke of Clarence. By the terms of the previous century, he had a better claim to the throne than Mary. But this old rivalry seemed quaint by the 1550s, when the two of them, Yorkist and Tudor, were united by religious zeal. They set about reversing all the changes that had been made since the break with Rome. In October 1553, all the religious laws of Edward VI's reign were repealed. In November 1554, the heresy laws of the 14th and 15th centuries were reintroduced. And in January 1555, the royal supremacy over the Church of England was repealed. The only thing that wasn't put back was the monasteries. This was deemed unworkable, as the aristocracy, Catholic and Protestant alike, had bought those lands from the crown, were really enjoying them, and, if it came down to it, gave much more of a shit about their vast new properties than they did about the difference between the Mass and Holy Communion. Weird, isn't it? People were willing to die for these religious differences, but they wouldn't sacrifice real estate. The English obsession with property came early. In the 16th century, religion was worth being burned to death for, but not worth losing land over. Then, in the 21st, when practically the entire economy was closed down because of COVID, estate agents were still allowed to do viewings, and there was a stamp duty holiday to stimulate the market. We're fucking nuts. Poor old Cranmer really didn't want to be burned to death and signed several recantations of his Protestant beliefs, and then recanted those recantations, finally being burned at the stake in 1556. I have a strong feeling that I'm supposed to be inspired by his integrity and heroism and that of all the other martyrs. But empathy fails me. I think they all needed to get a sense of perspective and say what they needed to say to avoid being burned. But that's just me. I avoid discussing trans issues on social media. The bleakness of the reign did not abate. Mary's unequal relationship with her husband, who, from 1556, was also King Philip II of Spain, resulted in her agreeing that England should join Spain in a war against France in 1557. This was something that her miserable, starving and diseased realm could ill afford, and its only tangible consequence came the following January, when the French took Calais. The last English outpost in France was gone. That fig leaf, which had, throughout the 14th century, concealed the ridiculousness of the English monarchy's claims on France, had been torn aside. Mary may have been the wife of a great king and the daughter-in-law of an emperor, but with that loss, the parochial mediocrity of her own kingdom was laid bare. Mary is supposed to have said of the disaster, "When I am dead and opened, you shall find Calais engraved on my heart." She wasn't great at human anatomy. She was always getting things wrong about her innards. At the same time that she said this, she had once again convinced herself that she was pregnant. She wasn't. It was probably cancer. She died on the 17th of November, 1558. Philip couldn't spare the time to visit his wife in her last weeks, but when the news of her death reached him, he did propose marriage to her successor, Elizabeth, so that was nice. Chapter 39. Queen Elizabeth I. Elizabeth rejected the proposal. She and Philip II didn't get on. The trademark Habsburg technique for taking places over having failed in this instance, Philip tried to do it the old-fashioned way by sending the Spanish Armada. This was much later, in 1588, by which point all of Catholic Europe was on a mission to destroy Elizabeth at the instigation of Pope Pius V, who had practically declared a crusade against her. In his papal bull of 1570, a bull is an edict but only one made by the Pope, in much the same way that a readeption is a restoration but only one happening to Henry VI, Pius declared Elizabeth illegitimate, excommunicated her, absolved all Catholics from obedience to her, even if they'd sworn oaths to the contrary, and, for good measure, excommunicated anyone who obeyed her. Now a Catholic couldn't even bring her the drink she'd ordered without going to hell. "What is this papal bull?" Elizabeth must have exclaimed. By 1588, England having been at war with Spain for 3 years already, and the English having harassed a lot of Spanish shipping, Philip thought he'd do the holy thing and seize the chilly little half-island and kill its queen. It just felt right. So he sent an absolutely enormous fleet of 130 ships. Apologies if that's fewer than you were expecting. Towards England, which was only defended by its tiny, plucky fleet of 200 ships. Go with it. So that it could pick up the Duke of Parma's army, the most feared of all fighting forces with internal rhyme, from Flanders and drop it off in England to then conquer the place. It's quite an involved plan, featuring not enough ships and involving coordinating lots of people to meet up 400 years before anyone had the technology to text anyone else with an ETA. Unsurprisingly, it fucked up. That's not how it was spun, though. Elizabeth preferred, "Amazingly, it fucked up." Or better still, "Amazingly, it was defeated." Defeated by English resolve, courage, righteousness, and naval valour, plus the all-important help of God, who we now definitely know was never a Catholic, despite going along with a millennium and a half of popes and saintly images and everyone claiming to be solemnly eating bits of his son. Harassed by the English fleet as it sailed east up the channel, dispersed by fireships while at anchor outside Calais, and then blown up the North Sea by the wind, the Armada didn't manage to pick up any troops, which was probably for the best, since most of it was smashed to bits by bad weather as it tried to find a way home round the north of Scotland and west of Ireland. This victory was the high point of Elizabeth's reign. She had withstood many attempts on her life, the sabre-rattling hostility of the head of international Catholicism, and now a full-on attack by the closest the 16th century had to a global superpower, apart from the Ottoman Empire and China. She was allowed to enjoy it, and she did. Philip II didn't propose marriage again, however. He obviously didn't find it sexy. Marriage. Like her father's reign, Elizabeth's was dominated by thoughts of marriage. On average, they got married 3 times each. Poor Elizabeth had 0 spouses. It looks as if she went to her grave straight from the shelf, where she'd been desperately hoping for a guy. That's not how it was. She didn't want to get married, but felt it impolitic to say so. She played along, apparently entertaining the notion of several suitors, including King Eric XIV of Sweden. Wow, 14 Erics. The Louis-loving French were only on 12 at this point. He sounds fun, and he was fun. He conquered Estonia, went insane, and was deposed. In general, Elizabeth used her eligibility on the international marriage scene to short-term diplomatic advantage, but never let it get too serious. She had her crushes, mind you. Most notably, she was very keen on her childhood friend Robert Dudley, another son of the Duke of Northumberland who had tried to put Lady Jane Grey on the throne. Small world. Dudley was Elizabeth's favourite for much of her reign, and she might have thought about marrying him, but he was already married. And then, in 1560, his wife died in suspicious circumstances, which made people suspect that he or Elizabeth had had her killed so that they could get married. But that very suspicion then meant they certainly couldn't get married, so if that was their plan, it was a bad one. They didn't marry, but in 1564 she made him Earl of Leicester instead. The reason for the pressure on Elizabeth to marry was the need to sort out the succession. She was the last of Henry VIII's children, and the other two hadn't lived very long. If Elizabeth died without issue, it wasn't clear who the next ruler would be, and 15th century history suggested that the clarification process would be bloody. Plus, the Reformation had now given everyone an extra reason to hate everyone else. When Elizabeth nearly died of smallpox in 1563, her ministers panicked, started making speculative lists, and questions were asked in Parliament afterwards. So why didn't she marry? We must resist the answers that conform to the value system of the many screen depictions of her, that she never fell in love, or she did fall in love with someone, but the match was forbidden by the mores of the time, and she could never bear to marry another. Fuck all that. The fact that she wasn't in love with anyone, or was in love with someone else, didn't get in the way of royal marriages in the 16th century. It didn't get in the way of Prince Charles's in the 20th century. Those royals weren't looking for love in a marriage, and for a monarch, a loveless marriage didn't preclude finding love elsewhere, unless you ran into someone unusually stubborn like Anne Boleyn. Elizabeth was Anne Boleyn's daughter, so maybe she had inherited some of that stubbornness, or, to put a more positive spin on it, sense of self-worth. Her other parent also had abnormal levels of self-esteem. Was it in that spirit of stubborn tyranny, contrarianism, that Elizabeth resisted the enormous pressure to marry? I don't think so. She was well-educated and very clever. Also, she'd had a traumatic life. Her mother had been executed when she was 2. She had endured the slur of bastardy, restoration to legitimacy, and bastardy again. Her brother's will had passed her over in the line of succession in favour of random cousins, and then her Catholic sister had suspected her of disloyalty for her whole reign, even briefly putting her in the Tower in the aftermath of Wyatt's rebellion. She acceded at a perilous time, with everyone wishing she were a man and half of everyone wishing she were a Catholic. The tenor of international relations having darkened somewhat in the previous half century, the latter group was not above trying to murder her. How does an intelligent person react to all this? With caution. The hallmark of Elizabeth's reign was caution. She didn't marry because to marry anyone was a risk. It would have weakened her position. It was also weakened by there being no clear succession, but either by calculation or by default, she took that long-term risk instead of the sharper immediate existential risk of being married to, and so owing obedience to, the wrong man. An English nobleman with a thirst for power, or a foreign prince with mental health issues. As time went on, and she didn't die, there were fewer short-term nerves among the magnates, and then it gradually became clear that she had become too old to have children. The pressure to marry was off, because it was too late for it to help with succession planning. Taking care of business. She showed similar caution about her religious policy. She was a Protestant and so had to reverse Mary's changes and turn England Protestant again. Her religious conscience aside, she would have been toast if she hadn't done that, as Protestants formed her entire support base. However, she was bitterly aware that this would alienate the Catholics. Unfortunately, it was a binary issue. There was no compromise third position that wouldn't have had both sides calling her a heretic. Centrism was even more intellectually unrespectable than it is now. So she turned the country Protestant again, but tried to soften the blow. She didn't like Catholicism, but she didn't tolerate Puritans either. The version of the Book of Common Prayer she introduced was milder, less alienating to Catholic sympathisers. She brought back Protestant forms of worship, but kept significant and mollifying Catholic elements, such as vestments. She repealed the heresy legislation and kept the penalties for recusancy, i.e. remaining Catholic, relatively mild. And in her Act of Supremacy of 1559, she made herself Supreme Governor, not Supreme Head, of the Church of England. These compromises of principle, in order not to upset people, set the Church of England on its path. It is despised by many for this. It is deemed to be soft, lacking in intellectual and theological rigour, trying to please everyone. Proper convinced Christians, and indeed ethical people of any belief system, should, it is often proclaimed, be fearless about upsetting people in order to uphold their values. Maybe, but I reckon most of the people who genuinely have no fear of upsetting others don't just have no fear of it, they actively enjoy it. Elizabeth didn't mind upsetting people, but she knew it was stupid and risky to do it unnecessarily, so her Protestantism was mild. She would not, as Francis Bacon apparently put it, make windows into men's souls. Don't ask, don't tell. It was a vital part of the process of England finding some sort of religious peace. You think what you like, just don't make a big fuss, and we can all rub along okay. This caution was also on display in her foreign policy, where it caused some frustration. As a leading Protestant monarch, she was supposed to get behind that cause across Europe, but her support for Protestants in the Dutch Netherlands and France was half-hearted and expense-averse. She provided too few troops, too poorly supplied, and preferred them not to get involved in fighting if possible. She was keener on naval actions, where Drake could whiz in, do some damage, steal some stuff, and whiz out. This approach may not have garnered much international success, but it protected her precarious position at home. Unlike her father, she had no interest in emulating Henry V, and she lacked the resources and opportunity to do so anyway. So did her father, but he was too vain to realise. She wanted to survive and prioritised that above glory. This wasn't, however, how she presented herself. Projecting caution would have been incautious. Outwardly, it was all grandeur and entitlement. She styled herself Gloriana and used her imposing image and beauty to dazzle. She emphasised feminine and masculine qualities and used their juxtaposition to entice. It was the PR equivalent of what salted caramel tastes like. She could turn on the Henry V act when she needed it. Her speech to the troops at Tilbury, preparing for the Duke of Parma's expected invasion, is spine-chilling, and delivered over a decade before Shakespeare put similarly stirring words in the mouth of her Lancastrian predecessor. "I know I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and think foul scorn that Parma or Spain, or any prince of Europe, should dare to invade the borders of my realm." Mary, Queen of Scots. Female rulers were suddenly all the rage. England was on its third in a row, if you count Lady Jane Grey, so Scotland had to have one too. This was Mary, Queen of Scots, who, to be fair, had acceded before any of the English queens in 1542 at the tender age of 6 days. That's even younger than Henry VI had been, and, like that Henry, the most successful section of her reign was the bit she played no conscious part in. In 1558, she married the Dauphin of France, and in 1559, he became King Francis II of France, and in 1560, he died. So that was a bit of a roller coaster. In 1561, still not 20, but already Dowager Queen of France, she returned to the other place she was Queen of, Scotland, and had a bash at ruling it. She took a very different approach to Elizabeth's. She kept marrying terrible men. But she was unlucky, too. She was Catholic, and so had Scotland been when she left. Unfortunately, in her absence, it had gone Protestant, quite firmly. Mary tried to go along with that, which disappointed the Catholics, but didn't allay the suspicions of the Protestants. Her position was weak, and she decided she needed a big, strong man to help her. So, in 1565, she married a psycho called Lord Darnley. He promptly knocked her up and murdered a man called David Rizzio, who was Mary's secretary, friend, and possibly lover, right in front of her while she was pregnant. All very Jeremy Kyle. The marriage didn't bounce back from there. Luckily, in 1567, Darnley was murdered, probably by someone called Lord Bothwell, who then abducted Mary, may have raped her, but definitely married her. She and Bothwell were not a popular couple to be running Scotland, and soon they weren't. In July 1567, she was forced by Darnley to abdicate in favour of her infant son, who was called James, and who was taken off to be brought up as a Protestant. Mary was imprisoned, but escaped the following year and fled to England, where she threw herself on the mercy of Elizabeth, who, you will be unamazed to hear, was also her cousin. Remember how one of Henry VII's daughters, Margaret Tudor, married King James IV of Scotland? This is where it becomes relevant. That branch of the family had been excluded from the line of succession by the terms of Henry VIII's will, but by blood were major claimants to the throne. Mary was Margaret and James's granddaughter, and a lovely Catholic option for Queen of England if anything should happen to Elizabeth. And a lot of people were working on that. So Elizabeth behaved cautiously as usual and put Mary in prison. Nice prison, but she wasn't allowed out. And that's where she stayed for 19 years. Was this a good sort of caution, or would it have been safer to kill her? She immediately became the focus of plots and rebellions. In 1569, there was a major Catholic rising in the north, which aimed to free Mary, marry her to the Duke of Norfolk, and put her on the throne. When it was defeated, Elizabeth had 600 rebels executed. So it wasn't just her sister who could be bloody. When the papal bull came out the following year, everything got more fraught. Still, Elizabeth resisted killing her cousin, but Sir Francis Walsingham, England's notorious spymaster, was piecing together a case against Mary. Not all the papist plotting, it seemed, was happening outside of Mary's ken. By late 1586, with England now at war with Spain, Elizabeth was willing to countenance putting Mary on trial. As a queen of another country, Mary refused to acknowledge the court's jurisdiction. Her view was that since she was a foreign head of state, she wasn't subject to English law. Also, she wasn't being tried by her peers. That would have involved assembling a jury of monarchs. Nevertheless, she was convicted of treason and sentenced to be executed. Elizabeth stalled over signing the death warrant and claimed, when she did sign it, that she hadn't meant it to be dispatched. Was this remorse, a sense of mercy, or just the ultra-cautious ruler's reluctance, as with marriage, to do anything irreversible? The Last Act. The defeat of the Armada in 1588 was Elizabeth's high point. Things went downhill after that. Militarily, the triumph against Spain was rather undermined the following year when Elizabeth sent her own massive armada, commanded by Sir Francis Drake, to Spain and Portugal. This was annihilated too, so maybe God was neutral, or Muslim. The Queen was ageing and her core team of ministers was dying. Dudley in 1588, Walsingham in 1590, her Lord Chancellor, Sir Christopher Hatton in 1591, and finally William Cecil, Lord Burley, her most trusted minister and counsellor who had supported her for the entire reign in 1598. The new generation of help was less reliable and less united. There was a power struggle between Robert Cecil, Burley's son, and Elizabeth's late reign favourite, the Earl of Essex. The old queen found it hard to restrain them. Caution and vigilance require energy, and hers was running out. She had no heir, but once Essex had disgraced himself by getting involved in a doomed and joyless rebellion, the younger Cecil was able to address that. Not in the obvious way, she was far too old. Mary, Queen of Scots' infant son, was now in his 30s and settled as the Protestant King James VI of Scotland. He was also Elizabeth's first cousin twice removed. Cecil encouraged a warm correspondence between the two sovereigns, and, to the extent that the old queen felt it safe to acknowledge her own mortality at all, she tipped James the wink. When she died in 1603, he inherited the throne without incident. Something else was happening while the queen and her government withered. A flowering of words. Amid Protestant suspicion of imagery, creativity was finding other paths. The English language, the heir to the Anglo-Saxon tongue, rejected by the ruling class for centuries after the conquest and then readopted and celebrated in the reigns of Edward III and Henry V, was coming into its own. It had been lurking in the background throughout English history, and its time had come. This was happening in the printed books that were increasingly available, but most startlingly, on stage. The golden age of Elizabethan drama defined the civilization that England was and went on to be. For the first time, the nation had the means to reflect upon itself. So much of this book is about that reflection. The kings that lived before the Elizabethan era were like the tree in the forest. Their noise was irrelevant until they were observed. England started to look at itself and see itself as Elizabeth faded away. Her self-consciousness as a sovereign was part of a broader trend that mattered more than any ruler or dynasty. Before Shakespeare, the Renaissance didn't hugely affect England. It was like a copy of French Vogue in a Guildford hairdresser's, just something people who wanted to be aware of things were aware of. It didn't touch many. When Shakespeare wrote Hamlet and it played to packed theatres, something new had begun. Renaissance is underplaying it. It was a birth, not a rebirth. But novelty is more approachable when spun as restoration. Bookend. My wife gives the best explanation of why William Shakespeare is brilliant. With most writers, she says, you know where they're coming from. Their prejudices, their upbringing, their milieu seep out of what they write. You can ignore it, or you can factor it in, but it's there. With Shakespeare, it isn't. He's too good at writing. She cites the phrase from Macbeth, boneless gums, as an example, as in the boneless gums of a baby that Lady M says she'd pluck her nipple from. My wife says it shows an instinctive understanding of what it's like to suckle an infant. If you say so, is all I can reply. How did a man write that, is her question, and, not being a moron, her answer isn't something like, ah, maybe he didn't, maybe Shakespeare is really Mary Queen of Scots. Her answer is, because he's the best. There had to be a best, and it happens to be him. I think he's the best too. I was lucky enough to portray him on television as an irascible, fearful, careerist sitcom character. I feel oddly close to him as a result, and very protective when people claim he doesn't exist. Historically speaking, there is no justification for the claim. Those who say, we know so little about him, seem to be unaware of how little we know about anybody from late 16th century England. Compared to most, William Shakespeare is documented in enormous detail. Why claim that he didn't exist? Or rather that the person of that name didn't write all those plays and poems, and assert that it was someone posher and therefore supposedly more plausible. The evidence doesn't support it, so to believe that nonsense, you really have to want it to be true. Who would want that to be true? Rather than the actual truth. Here's the actual truth. A man with a normal background and education, an impecunious member of the provincial bourgeoisie in a backward kingdom on a war-racked island at the edge of civilization, turned out to be the greatest writer and possibly the greatest artist of any kind who ever lived, so far. That might be the most life-affirming fact in the entire history of humanity. Sometimes it makes me want to cry with joy. It's such a celebration of what humans can be. To want the truth to be otherwise is an act of spite against the very sanctity of our species. He's where this book has been heading, it turns out. From King Arthur to William Shakespeare, a literary character to a literary genius. From someone everyone wishes existed to someone that some people, inexplicably, wish didn't. Shakespeare is a good reason to stop writing about kings because his brilliance makes them seem silly. And when they don't seem silly, it's just because he has put words into their mouths that they could never have thought of themselves. Richard II, for example, was a colossal twat. And yet Shakespeare has him say this: for God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. How some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court. And there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little scene, to monarchise, be feared and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable, and humoured thus, comes at the last and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king. Cover your heads, and mock not flesh and blood with solemn reverence. Throw away respect, tradition, form, and ceremonious duty. For you have but mistook me all this while. I live with bread like you. Feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king? It's poor characterization, isn't it? Richard didn't get within a million miles of that level of self-knowledge. Perhaps Shakespeare should have cut the speech. Although, in under 200 words, it says as much about the nature of kingship as I've managed in the rest of this book. To be fair to myself, I've put in more details, but still. Mock not flesh and blood with solemn reverence. Ultimately, the reverence shown to monarchs is a mockery, a joke. It's pretending they're something they're not. This is a bitter and clear reduction of kingship to its essentials, an office accepted only because an unjust hierarchy is preferable to anarchy. Out of the gangsterism of the lawless post-Roman land of Britannia, a few local big shots emerged, their power gradually coalescing into kingship. Mortal temples. It wouldn't have lasted if everyone had seen it as clearly as Shakespeare. The reverence for kings and queens had to be sincere, and over time, the revered had to come to believe they deserved it. It had to feel natural. To this day, the instinctive assumption that it is natural for a country to have a king and queen is deeply ingrained. Republics see themselves as a step forward from monarchy, something more advanced and fair, but even in that, there is an implication that countries start off as kingdoms. That is our original state. But it isn't. They don't. England didn't. It was a Roman province, part of an empire that was nominally a republic, though effectively a military dictatorship. Crowns, like Christianity, had to be introduced. The notion of royalty, of royal blood, hadn't always been. It had to be invented. In England, the more successful Anglo-Saxon tribal bullies turned themselves into kings. Following continental trends, they started adding ceremonial and religious elements, giving kingship an aura of legitimacy and sanctity. But it was just made up. At some point, someone with a sociopathic dislocation from the truth had to start asserting it, like the first conspiracy theorist who said that 5G masks spread COVID or that the current royals are lizards. Though there's a certain poetic justice to that last lie, that's where centuries of asserting that there is something holy and superhuman about a crowned royal will get you. When the Vikings started invading, a sense of English unity developed in opposition to the raiders. English national identity was first defined merely as not being Scandinavian or Celtic. Negativity can give you a strong sense of belonging, as Twitter shows. The most powerful of the families ruling the various Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, the House of Cherditch, gradually assumed leadership not only of the West Saxons, but all the Anglo-Saxons, and finally the Angli. As a result, microscopic quantities of Cherditch blood still flow in the veins of Britain's current king. The English monarchy's close association with France began with William of Normandy's dazzling smash and grab. For all the conqueror's talk of his right, it was a chancy piece of entrepreneurialism that spectacularly came off. A huge, surprising event that led to England being ruled by a French-speaking monarchy and aristocracy for centuries. The houses of Normandy and then Plantagenet were very proud to have their own kingdom, but in their hearts, those families were France-based. That was their centre of gravity. They would have jumped at the chance to trade England in for France. This gradually created tensions with the aristocracy in England. Those barons may have been totally Norman in 1066, but 100 years later they were decidedly Anglo-Norman, and when King John lost Normandy, they became English by default. They didn't share their monarch's France-owning ambitions, and this motivated them to find a way to limit their king's campaigning and spending. This imperative eventually led to Parliament. The randomness of it is wonderful to behold. Parliament came about as an indirect result of King Harold taking an arrow to the eye. It was the post-conquest king's split focus that caused the most significant English constitutional developments, not the deliberate policy of England's greatest kings. In fact, generally speaking, when the kings were any good, when they had the skill to balance competing interests, deploy brutality in a timely but predictable way, create stability through even-handedness and the judicious use of fear, their powers and prerogatives didn't change much, and the constitution remained the same. It was under the capricious or vacillating rulers, like John and Henry III, that the desperate barony reached for ways of limiting royal power. For all the regal professionalism of the likes of Henry II, Edward III and Henry V, their triumphs were fleeting and soon reversed, if not in their own lifetimes, then shortly afterwards. It was all pointless in the end, one of the many suggested titles for this book. The constitutional advances during the reigns of terrible kings, on the other hand, have lasted to this day. Magna Carta and Parliament are held up proudly as national achievements. I've got no problem with that, but the principles that were supposedly asserted through them, notions of representative government and the rule of law, weren't in the forefront of the minds of those who devised them. These nascent principles were straws the barons clutched at in the face of the huge principle they were ignoring, the doctrine at the core of medieval government that everyone owed obedience, loyalty, and homage to their anointed king. To us today, the idea of a king's God-given right seems like obvious bullshit. Back in the Middle Ages, what smelled of excrement, apart from everything, was the proposition that it was lawful to defy a figure of such sanctified authority as a king. The fine constitutional principles we have inherited from Magna Carta and Parliament started off as the mere rhetorical perfume the barons doused themselves in to cover the stench of their own treachery. It is vital to bear this in mind, because those surviving medieval institutions, and the high ideas we tell ourselves underlie them, are the main source of English and British national pride. Our sense of identity derives more from that feeling of continuity than from anything we think about ourselves now. The UK's Crown and Parliament and the judicial system of England and Wales are nominally the same entities that operated during the period covered by this book. They have merely undergone adaptation and reform. That's okay. In fact, it's pleasing, like an old house that still has Bakelite light switches. It's harmless as long as they've been properly rewired. But the story behind these constitutional artefacts is confused, contradictory, messy. Parliament, like the monarchy itself, was a random product of circumstance. Magna Carta was a failed attempt to prevent civil war. These developments were not driven by anyone's progressive conscience. Fondness may be a more appropriate thing to feel about them than pride. The death of kings. The words of kingly self-knowledge that Shakespeare gave to Richard II are not just insightful about the nature of kingship. They're also an astute reflection on how views about it were changing at the time of that king's fall. It was a hugely significant turning point. After centuries of unchallenged Plantagenet succession, an unquestionably legitimate ruler had been usurped. The loss of confidence in the notion of kingship expressed by Richard in the speech may not have been a realistic idea to put in the head of that particular crowned narcissist, but others were definitely thinking it. The idea of reining in difficult monarchs with things like Magna Carta and Parliament was based on the premise that the king was the king and that was that. Legitimate and anointed rulers were immovable, however incompetent. But when Bolingbroke stole the throne from Richard II by the simple use of military force, something that hadn't happened since the days of Henry I and Stephen, back when primogeniture was not yet established and the line of succession was consequently much fuzzier, that all changed. No need to focus on imposing financial or legislative encumbrances on bad kings. You can just overthrow them and bring in someone more conscientious. There's a weird paradox here. In a way, a less well-defined order of succession, a milieu where the next king can emerge from a wider group of leading magnates with royal blood, allows a greater element of meritocracy to enter the process. Back in Anglo-Saxon days, this meant Alfred could rule instead of his infant nephews. It made Henry I king instead of his feckless elder brother Robert, and it ushered in the capable and pious Henry IV instead of the vain idiot Richard II. But the positive consequences of this very limited meritocracy are totally outweighed by the loss of stability it causes. You may get better kings, but the transfer of power from one to the next is likely to be an absolute shitstorm. Plus, as Henry IV showed, the potentially capable king you then get isn't all he might be because A, he's terrified and watching his back, and B, people are less inclined to obey him because he's a usurper. They figure, why should they? He's just some guy. Maybe someone's going to usurp him in a minute. So the stability of the crown is undermined. This was a bit of a shame and made rather a mockery of the centuries that had been spent developing institutions to mitigate poor kingship. During the Wars of the Roses, Parliament sat there pointlessly like a fax machine in the corner of an office with Wi-Fi. Meanwhile, the exchanging of the throne between Lancastrians and Yorkists, both with imperfect claims to rule, permanently weakened people's belief in the monarchy's divine legitimacy. Also, it killed loads of people. By the time Henry Tudor took over, the deep Plantagenet belief in God and their right was a distant memory. Tudor was just a bloke, quite distantly related to the royal family. I mean, he had a surname, for God's sake. The Tudors did their best to project royalty and prestige. Henry VIII and Elizabeth I were particularly good at that, but the truth of royal power had been exposed for the first time since the Anglo-Saxon gang leaders put on airs and graces. That feels like a good place for this book to end. The great era of English kingship is over. That may feel like a grandiose assertion, with 420 years and counting more English monarchy between then and now, and millions tuning in so recently to watch the latest incumbent process to the Abbey for his hat and a splat. So let me explain the various ways in which it's true. First, after 1603, the kings and queens of England are also kings and queens of Scotland, or rather the other way round. James Stuart, already King of Scots, inherits England and Ireland too. It's another century before the Kingdom of Great Britain is officially ushered into existence, but that's the way things are heading, and that's a different story from that of medieval England, and a more complex one. Second, kings and queens become less dominant after 1603. Not immediately, but relatively swiftly. This book is about rulers, and by covering them, the political story of the age is more or less told. That's not the case from the 17th century onwards. Other people are more central. Prime ministers, foreign ministers, chancellors of the exchequer. Telling that history through the lives and doings of kings starts to feel antiquarian. The kings and queens are often interesting and remain major figures, but they don't matter so much. All of the monarchs I've talked about were at the epicentre of politics in a totally different way from, say, George II, let alone Edward VII. Much of the story around the crown descends to the level of golfing anecdotes, plus obviously a shitload of hunting. The third big sign that kingship as a concept is irrevocably on the slide is an event that happened less than half a century after Elizabeth's death, the execution of an English king by order of Parliament. By the mores of the centuries covered by this book, the judicial beheading of Charles I on a scaffold in Whitehall was as shocking as a public blowjob being administered on an altar. I feel sorry for Charles I, as I do for Richard II and Edward II and Robert Curthose. They were victims of the system as surely as all the millions of peasants whose existence is forgotten. But they were not, despite what they had been told about themselves, touched by the divine, or no more than all humans. They were not amazing people. Neither, really, were the supposedly great rulers of this time. They were capable, but they were also brutal, flawed, and fundamentally limited. Personally, I wouldn't rank Henry II, Edward III, Henry V, or Elizabeth I alongside Franklin D. Roosevelt, Nelson Mandela, or even Angela Merkel, let alone Jane Austen, Alfred Hitchcock, or Marie Curie. There must have been amazing people, but we don't hear about them because most of them couldn't write. They left no mark. But the flowering of Elizabethan drama, and Shakespeare in particular, is a reminder that they existed. Amazing people existed, but they did not seem to matter. That is probably the most far-reaching conclusion we can draw from centuries of violent kingship. These rulers are fun to remember. They are interesting, and it is weird, almost surreal, that such people were so powerful. There are still tyrants in the world today, and the strangeness of their power is something we must hold in mind. It's extremely odd. That fact can get lost in our anger at the injustice of what they do. The anger dignifies them. It makes them important. But they're not important. They're random. They're a product of a flawed system, like litter or traffic jams. The people themselves are as inconsequential as the biographical specifics of a burglar who has been enabled to take all your stuff by lax security, poor law enforcement, and a grim socio-economic environment. The rulers in this book inherited or acquired a lot of power. They did things that affected millions of people's lives. But if they hadn't, someone else would have done. Unlike Shakespeare, they were not important. We had but mistook them all this while.
We hope you've enjoyed this Penguin audio production of Unruly, A History of the Kings and Queens of England. Written and read by David Mitchell. It was produced by Chris Thompson, and the post-production was by Carl Gabidon. For more Penguin Audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Text copyright David Mitchell 2023. Copyright and recording Penguin Audio 2023. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.